Hello, and thanks for joining me on this episode of Groundworks, a collection of podcasts to encourage the work of shelter providers serving victims of domestic sexual exploitation. My name is Rosalind Lindner, and it's my honor to take you through one of the recent reports from the Institute for Shelter Care. In February 2020, the Samaritan Women Institute for Shelter Care sought to understand how residential programs serving victims of exploitation deal with the issues of addiction and sobriety. We issued a 34-question survey, and 26 agencies nationwide responded. What follows is a summary of the results, but you can download the report for free at our website, www.thesamaritanwomen.org. According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, substance use disorders occur when the recurrent use of alcohol or drugs causes clinically significant impairment, including health problems, disability, and failure to meet major responsibilities at work, school, or home. And according to the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychiatric Nursing, more than half of young people diagnosed with PTSD will later develop substance abuse problems. A study done by the University of Wisconsin-Madison shows that 89% of sexually trafficked women suffer physical violence, 83% suffered sexual violence, 100% experienced psychological violence, and more than 50% of women entering substance abuse treatment in the U.S. reported having traded sex for money or drugs in their lifetime. We can see this played out in the responses from shelter agencies surveyed for this report. 75% of all residents across responding agencies have been diagnosed with PTSD. 19% of all residents had substance use onset at or before the age of 10. 56% of residents had substance use onset between the ages of 11 and 19. 77% of residents across responding agencies had a diagnosis of substance use disorder. Given the data from these sources, it's now a matter of if a shelter agency will encounter residents with a comorbidity of trauma and substance abuse, but when. In this segment, we'll be giving an overview of our substance use disorder report, in which we take a look at policies and programming shelter agencies across the nation have put into place to help survivors of commercial sexual exploitation who are struggling with substance abuse. The results of the survey are augmented with research pertaining to the development of substance use disorder in individuals who have experienced or are currently experiencing trauma, to individuals struggling with substance use who have not necessarily experienced trafficking, and recovery homes that do not specialize in recovery from commercial sexual exploitation. Demographics for the responding agencies can be found in the full report available on our website, but to give you some context for the data presented in this segment, agencies that responded to our survey reported having been open and serving survivors anywhere from less than 2 years all the way to 15 plus years, with the most frequent range being between 4 to 6 years. Altogether, over the course of 2018 and 2019, these agencies have served 796 survivors, from whom our research data is derived. As we have already stated, it is guaranteed that shelter homes will, at some point, welcome into their program residents with the comorbid conditions of trauma and substance abuse. For this reason, it is important for each agency to decide, before they even open their doors, what policies will be best for their program. Policies can, of course, be modified as the agencies gain experience, new resources, and a deeper understanding of their residents' needs. Before we begin looking into the different models and policies surrounding care for those struggling with substance abuse, I'd like to take a moment to discuss a common barrier faced by women coming out of commercial sexual exploitation as it pertains to substance use. According to the same University of Wisconsin study mentioned earlier, a major barrier in entering a program is the requirement for a certain amount of days substance-free. It is nearly impossible to detox when living on the street or still under the control of a trafficker, and many places require a new resident to pass a drug test when she arrives at the program. There are often long wait times to enter a detox facility, and for many women, the only real chance they have to detox is jail or prison. 46% of agencies that responded to our survey require at least 30 days clean time before entry into the program. 35% require that the candidate has at least detoxed, and 19% of the agencies have no restriction on clean time. This is not to say that shelter programs should relax their clean time policies. It is of the utmost importance that programs protect the physical and mental safety of their current residents. Having someone come in the house who's high or detoxing certainly can pose a danger to current residents. Ideally, a shelter agency would seek out and form a partnership with a local detox facility that can care for the residential candidates until it's safe for them to enter the shelter home. The survey asked each agency to pick one of four common treatment philosophies which most closely resembles their own. The least common philosophy among our sample set, used by only 8% of responding agencies, is the harm reduction model. This model doesn't necessarily aim to end substance use, but to provide the means for those who choose to use to do so safely. The most common philosophy among our sample set, 38% of agencies, is the abstinence model, which centers on personal will and equips residents to live a life free of substance abuse. The next most common, at 30% of responding agencies, is the behavioral model, which sees substance use as a choice and relies most heavily on cognitive and behavioral interventions. Finally, 19% of responding agencies most closely align with the medicalized model, which treats substance abuse as a disease and endeavors to reduce the risk of overdose and acute withdrawal symptoms through the use of medication, sometimes accompanied by behavioral therapies. There are different opinions on the acceptability of medication-assisted treatment, both among shelter services and residential drug and alcohol recovery homes. Two major supporters of medication-assisted treatment are the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration and the National Association of Recovery Residences. SAMHSA's website states that medication-assisted treatment can improve patient survival, increase retention in treatment, decrease illicit opiate use and other criminal activity, increase a patient's ability to gain and maintain employment, improve birth outcomes among pregnant women with substance use disorders, and reduce the potential for relapse. NARR states that medication-assisted treatment is one of many viable recovery tools, and that recovery residents are not legally allowed to deny admission solely on the basis of an applicant's use of physician-prescribed medications. Among organizations in agreement on the viability of medication-assisted treatment, there are differences in opinion over which medications are acceptable in a residential facility. These differing opinions are reflected in the data from the shelter homes responding to our survey. We asked shelter agencies if they will accept, might accept, or won't accept, or have no policy for a residential candidate currently taking any of these six common MAT medications: methadone, naloxone, and buprenorphine, all used to treat opioid addiction; naltrexone, used to treat both opioid and alcohol addiction; acamprosate and disulfiram, both used to treat alcohol addiction. You can see a full list of responses in the report. I'm just going to pull out some highlights here. Of these six medications, 54% of agencies said that they would accept a residential candidate currently taking naltrexone. 31% of agencies said that they would accept a residential candidate currently taking naloxone. 27% of agencies would accept buprenorphine. Methadone was the least accepted treatment, with 50% of agencies saying they would not accept a candidate currently taking the medication. This is followed closely by naloxone and buprenorphine, both of which were marked will not accept by 42% of agencies. So what does this mean for shelter agencies who may be designing or reevaluating their policies on medication-assisted treatment? The diversity among agencies shows that there is no one right or wrong answer. There can be benefits and drawbacks to each type of medication-assisted treatment. Each agency must consider both internal and external resources available to their residents, as well as aspects of the program that may or may not support the policy of their choice. One programmatic support for medication-assisted treatment is how medication is dispensed. In some states, this decision is made for the agency, particularly in programs that serve minors, by the governing authorities, which may require a licensed medical professional oversee all prescribed medications, including prescriptions for medication-assisted treatment. Of the agencies responding to our survey, 35% have staff members either administer the medication or observe the resident as they take the medication. 12% of responding agencies give their residents full control over their own medications. 19% of agencies take their residents to a local clinic to receive their medications, and 8% have a licensed medical professional on staff to distribute residents' medications. It can be difficult for the program developer to walk the line between wanting to give residents autonomy and wanting to protect them. Many prescribed medications can be harmful or have narcotic effects if used incorrectly or mixed with other medications. A lot of residents coming into shelter programs have not learned how to properly take medications. They may not understand the importance of taking medicine as prescribed, or may be struggling with addiction and prone to misusing their medications, or those of their fellow residents. As with all other policies, it is up to each agency to determine what policy will be most suited to the needs of their clients. I'd like to move on now to some other practical ways that shelter programs can support the recovery of their residents. The National Association of Recovery Residents states in their Policies and Procedures Manual, "If the physical home is the heart of the recovery residents, then the recovery support offered there is the soul." Given the variety of addictions and comorbid conditions trafficking survivors struggle with, it is so important for a shelter agency to explore all the options available to them to provide a diverse and full-bodied support system to their residents. One of the most basic policies to start with is drug testing. Drug testing provides each resident with accountability for her actions regarding their sobriety. And as with all policies, there are different approaches, and each shelter agency must decide what is best for their residents. For this section of the survey, respondents were asked to choose every option that applies to their program. Drug testing policies most commonly included testing at intake and randomized testing, followed closely by testing when drug use is suspected. Only 12% of agencies reported not testing residents at any point in the program. For a list of all responses, please see the full report. Whether or not an agency has drug testing policies in place is utterly important for the physical and emotional safety of residents to have a plan in place for what to do when a resident is found using drugs or alcohol. Having a plan in place that is known by the residents helps them to feel secure, knowing that should the worst happen, staff and volunteers are prepared to handle the situation. 69% of responding agencies stated that they handle substance use infractions on a case-by-case basis. 50% stated that the resident would be placed on program probation if found with intoxicating substances. 38% stated that the resident would be dismissed from the program. 15% of agencies state that they would require the resident to attend counseling. 12% of agencies have a three-strikes policy, and 8% have a two-strikes policy prior to dismissal. A safety plan is an excellent way to help a resident make good choices when the desire to use feels overwhelming. To create a safety plan, a staff member helps each resident to identify triggers, feelings, and thoughts that can lead to an urge to use drugs or alcohol. Then, together, the staff member and resident come up with a course of action that will help the resident feel safe and secure. Knowing that when the urge to use feels overwhelming, there's someone to whom she can turn and practical steps she can take to get through it. A designated person to whom residents can go for sobriety support is an important resource for a shelter program. That designated person can come in different forms. 19% of responding agencies have a licensed addictions or drug and alcohol counselor on staff, while 58% contract with a community partner to provide professional addiction support services. 38% of agencies meet this need through a staff member who is not a licensed addictions counselor, but who has a background in recovery or has received training on how to counsel residents with addiction recovery needs. Though these individuals may not be licensed, they provide invaluable support to residents who are just beginning their sobriety journeys. Peer mentors are another way to come alongside residents as they begin their sobriety journey. An overview of addictions intervention programs states that peer mentorship is beneficial to both the mentor and the mentee, in that while helping the mentor furthers her own 12-step work. Half of all responding agencies use this method to help their residents. 31% of agencies have survivors who have themselves been through recovery and maintain sobriety mentor their residents. One agency pairs newer residents with those that are further along in their recovery. In addition to one-on-one support, group sobriety support is essential for residents struggling with addiction. Nearly all responding agencies stated facilitating in-house groups on addiction, coping skills, substance use alternatives, and similar topics. The most popular curriculum used is Seeking Safety, followed by Teen Challenge, Breaking Free, and 12-Step Recovery Resources. Other resources reported as helpful are the Celebrate Recovery Curriculum, Amazing Grace Addiction Bible Study, and the Genesis Program. Of course, agencies don't have to pick just one. Diversifying curriculum and even in-house development of materials specific to the program can be helpful in meeting the diverse needs of residents. External groups can also be a major source of encouragement and support for residents in recovery. As discussed earlier, survivors of commercial sexual exploitation have a high likelihood of comorbid conditions directly related to their trafficking situation. Because of unique recovery needs, it's best to have a mix of internal and external sobriety groups, which 50% of agencies that responded to our survey say that they do. Based on a study of 10,000 individuals in recovery, CNN reported that Alcoholics Anonymous has been proven to be one of the most effective recovery tools, largely because it treats addiction as a long-term, chronic illness, rather than a problem with a short-term solution. For those suffering from comorbid conditions, a study in Social Work Public Health states that concurrent involvement in specialty treatment and in 12-step groups contributes to better outcomes than either one alone. But AA isn't the only option. Other groups such as Narcotics Anonymous and Celebrate Recovery also offer community-based sobriety support. We asked shelter agencies whether they found these kinds of community-based programs helpful, challenging, or a little bit of both, and why they felt that way. 60% of agencies found them helpful, naming some benefits such as residents not feeling singled out because of their addiction, finding encouragement in other people's testimonies, receiving milestone coins, connecting with a sponsor, and instilling the habit of attending groups even after leaving the program. 33% found the groups both helpful and challenging, and 7% found the groups challenging. Both groups named such challenges as 13th steppers, which are men who approach female residents with the goal of starting a romantic relationship under the guise of mentorship. There are no restrictions on meeting, so sometimes people show up high or drunk, and a feeling of discouragement when hearing other people's struggles. The biggest concern was that there are a lot of opportunities for residents to feel triggered, either by other attendees or the stories they are told. Some agencies also reported that these community groups continue to be a source of social support to residents even after they've left the shelter program. AA groups have both open meetings and closed meetings. During an open meeting, anyone can attend and observe. This would be a good opportunity for a program director to check out local AA groups before having residents attend. It's important to do research into local sobriety support groups when making the best decision for the health of the residents. In the last set of programmatic questions, we asked whether faith is a part of the agency's residential program and how that impacts their residents' response to sobriety. 31% of agencies state that they include spiritual programming but do not promote a faith position, while 58% state that they have religious programming and are distinct in their religious character. The section of our survey invited open-ended comments on how faith practices are evident in the residents' recovery. The prevailing theme throughout the comments in this section is the creation of new, positive thought patterns for residents who have largely lived their lives with negativity towards themselves, others, and the world. This theme is followed closely by the theme of unconditional love and forgiveness. Some something else that many residents have not experienced in their lifetime. I encourage you to read the full report for some very inspiring answers from our respondents. After learning about the various programmatic features of sobriety support, we asked agencies to share with us the metrics that they use to determine residents' progress. 19 agencies responded to how their program measures impact for residents who have SUDs. Over half of the agencies determine a resident's success either by having goals that she achieves or by marking progress through milestones. Programs focus on improvement in interpersonal relationships, personal responsibilities such as hygiene, chores, or initiative during groups or academic time, and aspects that are integral to moving on to the next phase of the program or individual plan. Other methods used to track sobriety include charting clean days, symptom reduction, drug test results, medical reviews, and self-reporting. Tracking relapses and having a relapse prevention plan is another frequently mentioned metric. One agency reported tracking residents to up to 5 years after they have left the program, which is an area of opportunity for future research. At least one study suggests that women in residential treatment programs, in contrast to intensive outpatient programs, may have greater vulnerability for relapse given an underdeveloped social support network post-residential program. Programs should not be discouraged or think that they do not have significant impact on a survivor's sobriety journey. They serve as a starting point and as a critical bridge between life on the street, where substance use is the only escape, and long-term recovery programs where survivors can learn a new way to live. Shelter programs serving victims of domestic sex trafficking may not be all that distinguished from addiction recovery homes. Both are providing two critical ingredients to the recovery process, a change in setting and time, with the same goal of endeavoring to effect sustainable change in the person who is suffering. Beyond those commonalities, there are a variety of approaches in practice. The addiction recovery space has a larger service population, more longevity, more treatment options, and a deeper base of research and outcomes on which to draw. There is much from which trafficking shelters can glean. What trafficking shelters are bringing into the forefront, perhaps, is the issue of comorbidity between addictions and chronic, complex, and relational trauma. Current studies of addiction recovery houses points to a best practice that is a holistic approach to improving the overall health and well-being of the individual beyond substance dependence. As the field of shelter care for trafficked persons matures, we hope to see greater collaboration with art and science of addictions recovery and a deeper understanding of how trauma and addiction must be considered as twin issues in the harms done to human life. Thank you for tuning into this podcast. We hope the work of the Institute for Shelter Care advances your service to survivors.